The 11th chapter of Ezekiel begins by showing the political corruption of the city. He shows how the rulers of the city had so misled the people and had so perverted the teachings of God that they were going on a course that was entirely different from what God intended for them to do. And because of their misguidance, because of the fact that they were going contrary to God, it would simply hasten the destruction of the city. So it begins in the first verse. Moreover, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me unto the east gate of the Lord's house, which looketh eastward. Now you know the last chapter closed with God leaving the temple by way of the east gate. Now Ezekiel is brought to that place, and notice what he sees at that point. And behold, at the door of the gate, 25 men, among whom I saw Jezaniah the son of Azur, and Pelatiah the son of Benaiah, the princes of the people. Now these 25 men were the rulers, what is called the princes of the people. Some have said that Jerusalem was divided into 24 sections. Each one had a ruler over that section, and then there was a mayor making the number 25 who was governor over all. This could possibly be what this is referring to, or something similar to this. But two of these men were so prominent in Ezekiel's knowledge that he recognized them, and he calls them by name, Jezaniah and Pelatiah. Now this is a different Jezaniah than from the one we had earlier, because he has a different father. He's the son of Azur. Ezekiel probably knew these men from his prior residence in Jerusalem some several years before this. But these men had assembled here at the door of the gate. This seems to be some kind of a council session, some kind of a board meeting of the rulers of Jerusalem. And they were in a state in which they considered to be secure. But Ezekiel is allowed to observe them as they go about this activity of carrying out this meeting. Verse 2, then said he unto me, Son of man, these are the men that devise mischief and give wicked counsel in this city. So God gives Ezekiel a picture of their character. There are men that devise mischief. There are men that give wicked counsel in this city. So often we see this happen. Those that are in authority, those that have the rule and the power over a city or over a nation or a state or a region, they give wicked counsel. They give ideas that really are devising of mischief. These are the people who make wars. These are the people who make decisions and judgments that cause the young men to be killed in the course of battle, that cause the women and children to have to suffer because of battle. You know, every time there's a war, somebody loses. Maybe both sides lose, but somebody loses. And the sufferers are not the ones who make the war. They're not the ones who declare the war. The sufferers are those who are the more or less innocent victims of their wicked counsel and of the mischief that they have devised. And that's what had happened here in the city of Jerusalem. These rulers had given the wrong counsel to the people. They were actually devising mischief. Now God intended for the city to be destroyed. He intended for the people to be carried into captivity. Jeremiah was prophesying that they were to yield to the Babylonians. They were to give in to their demands and their desires, for this was the will of God. But these rulers were giving counsel just the opposite of that. They wanted the people to resist. They wanted the people to fight. They wanted the people to fortify themselves against the Babylonians. And consequently, this would simply wind up in their absolute ruin. It was going to cause them to be destroyed rather than to simply be carried away into captivity. They would be destroyed by the sword and by famine and by the diseases and the pestilences that would come upon them. So they gave wicked counsel in the city. And the pages of history are full of similar instances to this in which the rulers, the leaders, those that are placed in authority, give wicked counsel and they devise mischief. And we wonder about the leaders of the day, presently, who are leaders over this country and the other nations of the world. What kind of counsel are they giving? What kind of mischief are they devising? What kind of severe, serious problems are we going to get into as a result of their misguidance? We've seen it happen in the recent past. We've been through war after war after war. We've seen greed bring about inflation and unemployment and deplorable conditions in the land. And yet those that are in authority continue to give wicked counsel. Verse 3, he shows what kind of deception they were using, which say, "It is not near. Let us build houses. This city is the cauldron, and we are the flesh." Now, this is a difficult verse to fully explain because we have at least two different ideas that can be gotten out of this verse. Some people say that what they are saying is that it is near, that is the siege of the city, the attack by the Babylonian army is near, that it's not the time to build houses, it's time to fortify the city, because this city is the cauldron and we be the flesh, that is, we're going to be destroyed in this city like a boiling pot would destroy the flesh that's in it as a result of the fire that heats the pot up. Now that's one interpretation. That doesn't seem to be exactly what the grammar says here, but it's the way that some have interpreted this to make the meaning a little smoother. And as he goes on and says that you have filled the streets with the slain and they will be the flesh and the city will be the cauldron for them, that they're the ones who are going to actually die in the city and as flesh would be boiled in the pot. However, there's another interpretation of this, which may very well be what he's talking about. These wicked princes are simply saying that the destruction of the city is not near, as this verse plainly says. Let us build houses. Let us go on about our business. We're in a secure place. And this is a proverbial statement. This city is the cauldron, we be the flesh. That is, we are preserved, we are safe inside the city because the city is like a copper pot and we're like the flesh inside the pot and we're not going to be harmed. We're not going to be taken out. We will be kept safe inside the pot. Nobody's going to reach his hand in to get us out. A wild animal passing by is not going to bother us because we're preserved in this pot with the fire on the outside of the pot. And that's a logical explanation of this because it more nearly follows what is stated here in the grammar. There's also a possibility that this could be a mocking of the prophecy given by Jeremiah, in which Jeremiah depicts the city as a seething pot. In Jeremiah 1 and 13, "And the word of the Lord came unto me the second time, saying, What seest thou? And I said, I see a seething pot, and the face thereof is toward the north." So Jeremiah depicted this city as being a seething pot, and so this could be a mockery of that prophecy given by Jeremiah. The people are mocking by saying, "Why, yes, the city is a seething pot with the flesh inside. So what?" But it seems to be that the idea that this is a proverb that is depicting their safety and their security by being in this copper pot, as flesh would be protected by a pot, is a likely explanation of what they're saying here. Verse 4, "Therefore, prophesy against them, prophesy, O son of man." So Jeremiah is here told to give them a warning. He's told to prophesy against them. Let them know that they're in a precarious position. Let them know that they're dealing with the true God. And if they do not change their course, if they do not change their philosophy, do not change the wicked counsel that they're given this city, the misdirection that they are leading the people into, that they're going to have some terrible things, the judgment of God, to fall upon them. So Ezekiel is told to prophesy against them. Let them know about this. And here's where it takes courage on the part of the prophet. Courage on the part of those who would be in a position to teach the Word of God, to be able to stand up and to tell somebody that they're wrong, to tell somebody that they're going to have to change, to tell somebody that the consequences of their action is going to be the judgment of God. So, in verse 5, Ezekiel is told what to speak. And the Spirit of the Lord fell upon me and said unto me, speak, thus saith the Lord. Now, Ezekiel wasn't told to go out here and use his own judgment as to what to say, use his own mind, his own reasoning power. He was not to outline a nice little speech to give to these people. He was to say what the Lord said. He was to speak the things the Lord gave him to speak. He was to quote the Lord. And so it is today when we teach, we are to quote the Lord. We are to read distinctly from the book of the law of God. We are to give the sense of the reading and cause the people to understand the reading according to Nehemiah 8, verse 8. It's not ours to give a speech. It's not ours to use our own judgment, our own ability to persuade or to convince, but we use the words of God. The word of the Lord is the only power that we have. As Paul says in Romans 1, verse 16, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So we have to stick with the words of God. Let's let God do the speaking, and we only act as the agent through which the speaking is given. Not our mind, not our idea, not our speech, or our outline, or our philosophy. But God does the speaking. And that's the case here with Ezekiel. The Spirit of the Lord fell upon me and said unto me, speak, thus saith the Lord. So we have Ezekiel now speaking, but it's God speaking through him, and we can be confident that the things that are said here really are the things of God, not the things of the man, Ezekiel. And this is what the Lord said to Ezekiel. Thus have you said, O house of Israel, for I know the things that come into your mind, every one of them. The first point that God makes here is that he is aware of what the people are thinking. He knows what comes into the mind. He knows every one of them. This is true even today about God and us. God knows us. He knows us better than we know ourselves. Because just realize all the thoughts that we have that may be fleeting thoughts, and we may forget about them in a matter of minutes or seconds or days, yet God knows all these thoughts. He still knows them. He hasn't forgotten them. He's well aware of them. So in that sense, he knows us better than we know ourselves. We don't even remember ourselves, everything that we think of. And that's true of the people here in Jerusalem. These leaders who were misguiding the people, who were giving them wicked counsel, who were devising mischief, and who were going to lead the city into total ruin and destruction and cause the death of thousands of people. He says, I know the things that come into your mind, every one of them. Verse 6, and this is the second point he makes. You have multiplied your slain in the city, and you have filled the streets thereof with the slain. Now, this probably doesn't necessarily mean that these rulers had gone out and killed the people in the city. But it does mean that by their judgments, by their counsel, that was wicked counsel, it went against the will of God, they had made the decisions that then that caused the slain in the city to be multiplied and the streets of the city to be filled with the slain. Because they were resisting the desires of Babylon, because they were not submitting to the demands of Nebuchadnezzar like God wanted them to, then they were causing great destruction to be brought upon the city and great death to be brought upon the people. So in the last analysis then, the death of the people brought about by the Chaldean army was really the fault of and to be blamed upon the poor decision of the leaders. And of course we can see that's true in world politics even today. Many thousands of innocent people die because the leaders of their country made poor decisions. Decisions about war. Decisions about resisting when there was no need to put up this kind of a resistance. We know this must have been a very terrible thing to have had all these slain in the city to be multiplied, to have the streets filled with the slain. We know of massacres that occur even today in modern times that have filled the streets with the bodies of the slain by the hundreds. It's a very terrible, terrible scene. But yet, usually at the base of all of this, it's some kind of political corruption, decisions made by leaders of this group against leaders of that group, but yet the poor innocent people are the ones who really have to suffer this tragedy. And so, in the last analysis then, it's the leaders who are responsible. You have multiplied your slain in this city, and you have filled the streets thereof with the slain. Verse 7, therefore thus saith the Lord God, and this is the third point that he's making, your slain, whom you have laid in the midst of it, they are the flesh, and this city is the cauldron. Now, depending upon which view we take of this proverb about the cauldron and the flesh, if we look upon it as the city being a cauldron that would give them protection as the flesh inside the pot, so that nothing was going to hurt them, then the only ones that would receive the protection of the city would be those that had been put to death, those that had been slain. Now, this is not really a far-fetched way to look at this, because one of the means that God was going to use to protect the righteous would be to allow them to have a death. They then would no longer be involved in the siege of the city, the pestilences and the famine, and later the degrading thing of captivity. And we find in Isaiah 57, verses 1 and 2, where Isaiah seems to make an allusion to a very similar thing. He says, the righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart. And merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. He shall enter into peace, they shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. So he talks about the righteous here that are taken away, entering into peace, resting in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. And this seems to be talking about the death of the righteous people at the time of the captivity. And he says, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. They're being spared the evil to come. God is protecting them, and he's chosen the means of protection here, just simply to be to let them die a peaceful death, and then they're protected from the evil to come. So here he talks about the fact that the slain, they are the flesh, and the city is the cauldron. Now that is if we're looking upon the cauldron as being a source of protection. But if the proverb of the flesh and the cauldron is talking about the destruction of the people within the city, then here again it would only be these dead that he's talking about that would be the ones who would be allowed to die in the city, because the destruction of the rulers was going to be without the city. They would be brought out of the city and made to be destroyed elsewhere. But our time has expired. We'll conclude at that point for now. Thank you.